Okay, so, excuse me, we're picking up in Revelation 13, and we'll read it in a certain way that there are breaks in this chapter. We'll read the whole chapter. We'll read it in such a way that kind of flows with the breaks, and the way we'll do that is I'll just have different ones of you read certain sections complete, and then the next one read like the next little break, just to kind of help demonstrate that. So, Sister Roseanne, would you read verses, Revelation 13, verses 1 through 8? Sister Cheryl, would you read verses 9 and 10? And Ruth, would you read verses 11 through 14, and then Sister Carrie, could you read 16 through 18? I think I've got it. All right.
Revelation 13, 1 through 8. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous names. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 40. And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in the heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world.
9 and 10. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints.
And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Should I continue?
I think I overlapped a verse there. Sister Carrie, go ahead with 16 through 18.
Well,
And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here's wisdom, let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666.
All right, thank you. So, again, now here we are, we've got a glimpse of these divisions to a certain extent in the chapter. And we'll go back to our verse 1. And when it says, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, saw a beast rise up out of the sea. It has 7 heads, 10 horns, upon the horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name," King James, but the margin and the Greek is names plural, of blasphemy. Just we make that observation. So who's the I, and why is it standing on the shore? What would that symbolize? Ruth?
Well, I guess it would be the John class, or it would be the Apostle John in the vision. But some manuscripts have it referring to the dragon, and he stood upon the sands of the sea in verse 17. But either way, you're on the sands of the sea, and John's seeing a beast rise up out of the sea.
All right, very good. So we have this sense of the watchers are on the sidelines. And they're on the sand. They're not in the sea. So it shows those who have some sense of religious restraint, as it were, those who are not restless like the sea, the restless masses of people, and they're on the sidelines and they're beholding what's taking place before them. And this beast rising up out of the sea, it reminds us of our Wednesday night study in Daniel, the 7th chapter, where we address this very same point, that the four winds drove on the sea, and then we had the four beastly animals come up out of it. And we determined, of course, that those are four governments that had control over Jerusalem during the 2,520-year interregnum between the fall of the typical kingdom of Israel in 606, with their last king being dethroned, and the incoming new kingdom, the 5th universal empire, at the end after World War I, a further step in the development of God's kingdom with the actual kingdom being set up, not the typical kingdom, and Israel being in the process of restoration after that 2,520 years, being going to be the earthly seat of power of that kingdom. So we discussed all that on Wednesday night. It was a great study. We take what we learned there in that part, and we apply a similar lesson here, and we're recognizing that this beast, again, is another form of a government. And with the identifiers of the 7 heads and 10 horns, we recognize that it is the Roman Empire that's being referred to, that this beast is a part of, as it were. Even as in the 12th chapter, chapter 12, Revelation 12, verse 3, we saw that the dragon had 7 heads and 10 horns. We'll talk about the placement of the crowns in a moment. So that too was the Roman Empire, the tail end of it, when Constantine nominally adopted Christianity and the Roman Empire changed from paganism to nominal Christianity, that point of time, and that now we're seeing, slightly after that period, we're seeing a beast rise up, And we see this interaction between the dragon and the beast, with the beast becoming the superior form of government, as it were. So we're going to state what we've said before, just because we studied and talked about this, that we believe a beast is a religious government, chiefly religious, but it's a religious government, and that this beast in particular is representative of, we've all studied this, as the papacy, and it's being developed out of the masses of the empire. It consolidated and arose from what was left of the Roman Empire, under its rulers, and now it's developing to become its, the ruler itself. That's what we're seeing here in this chapter. Now, if we had come straight from Revelation 12, back when we studied it, instead of our side study on heads and horns, if we'd come straight to this chapter from chapter 12, we would have remembered that in chapter 12, we saw the struggle between the civil authority of the empire, the dragon and his angels, warring with Michael and his angels. That's Revelation 12 and verse 7. And we recognize this was a counterfeit Michael. And this was a line of popes and the papacy. And there was a struggle between the papacy developing and the civil power of the empire, who would have control. And we learned that the papacy gained the control. The counterfeit Michael won that struggle. If we had stayed in that when we came to chapter 13 here, we would say that while we're picking back up with that theme, but now we've advanced. We've ratcheted forward to the period of time where we're seeing that the papacy, this beast, is transitioned into a more formalized form of a government than had been previously seen. So the 12th chapter showed us the transition in part, and now we're in the 13th chapter, we're seeing that transition more fully realized. Does that initiate any comments? Okay. So we've discussed the seven heads are successive forms of government. The ten horns are ten powers that can be concurrent, that the number seven has its sense of completion and perfection, and the number ten has its sense of completion. And so that's made relevant, that's demonstrated to us here. We left off last week. We had suggested that we've been talking. Well, we mailed this out on January 21st, as a friend pointed out in an email. I emailed it out. I looked back to 45 individuals. So it was three pages, and it was comments about the heads and horns with a lot of harvest message references. And we spent a lot of time in our studies going through Daniel 7 and reading the harvest message references, and then we went into Revelation 17, which, of course, we just completed verse by verse. All along the way, in discussing the possible seven heads, we had tried to demonstrate as we were going along my personal opinion on why I wasn't satisfied completely with any of the lists that other brethren have put together, even though every list is a help to our understanding, no doubt. But in our minds, there does seem like there was a struggle with each one. We were closer to some than others, but we'll just state here again as what we sent out. We think that because in Revelation 17, the woman sits on the seven mountains, we think that that demonstrates that papacy had to be in existence as an influence for the time that we would start counting our seven heads. And so our first head was Constantine, because he was influenced by the nominal Christians already in his day when he held the Nicene Council in 325 AD, which you all remember, the Council of Nicaea, the debate on whether or not Jesus was of the same nature as God. Our beloved Arius, the defender of the truth, that they were separate and the Son was inferior to the Father. He was created against Athanasius, who led the argument that they were of the same nature. And the Athanasian element had the chief influence on Constantine at the council, and Constantine decided the matter based on these religious input, and he sided with Athanasius that God and Jesus were the same substance, homoousia, and Arius was excommunicated. Later in life, Constantine had a change of heart. He invited Arius back to visit Rome, and Arius died mysteriously on his way to Rome, some thinking he was poisoned by enemies. But nonetheless, to my mind, that's why we started our list with Constantine and the Western Empire. Constantine moved the seat of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, but yet there was a strong Western Empire presence. You will remember that Rome is considered the western part of the Roman Empire and Constantinople the eastern part. Now, they looked at it as one whole empire, but there was these two regions, if you will. And that was from that first head would have been 313 to 476. And then we had the second head were the Goths. First the Visigoths, then the Ostrogoths. These were in the west. These had their successive roles in controlling much of Italy. And we had that from 476 to 539. Then the third head we had is Justinian the First. He actually started in 527, and we just feel that Justinian the First, and then his those that followed after him till 800 AD, basically, they were in the eastern part of the empire, but they exercised their influence. And Justinian the First, in fact, as we know, in 533, and then again in 539, there were these important dates in which Justinian's general Belisarius defeated the Goths, the last Ostrogoths, the Ostrogoths, who were held up in Ravenna, which we looked on a map. We saw together why Ravenna was the leading city, because it was at the northern part of the Italian peninsula and was best situated for defending the peninsula from attackers from the north, even though Rome had always still been a city of some import. And then we started the fourth head, Charlemagne, in the Roman Papal Empire from 800 to 1799, with the Pope crowning Charlemagne, unsuspectedly to him. But that was the start of the counterfeit millennium, 1,000-year period, and of which was, you might call, papacy's heyday. And then we had the fifth head as Napoleon and his descendants. From 1799, when he imprisoned the Pope was imprisoned twice, and he died in prison. Sorry, 1799 to 1870, there was Napoleon and his descendants' influence, and then the sixth head is Victor Emmanuel from 1870, Victor Emmanuel the First from 1870, when he reunited Italy, taking away the papal states from the Vatican. And he had his descendants, and they continued in some fashion. Then our seventh head was the fascist Nazi regime from the 1930s to 1945. Then our eighth is a repeat head. He is of the seven. We think that's a return of a church and state government That's similar to the fourth head. It'll be just for a hour of power, very short. And we believe the Protestant daughters will be affiliated with the mother harlot papacy, and together they will work with the kings of the earth, the ten horns. And they'll, so we that's our suggested list of the eight heads, if you will. And we're not, certainly not dogmatic on it. There's certainly can be reasonable differences indeed. So I've just said that much here, but I'm now, are there any comments on that? Sister Debbie.
Just a question, jotting this down. Nazism pretty much ended at the end of World War II.
Yeah, 1945.
So the return of the church-state union, there's going to be a lull between kings here?
Yeah, between the heads, yeah.
Okay.
And it's interesting because it says of those 10 kings who – what the 10 horns are 10 kings, which give their power unto, this beast for an hour, says they have no kingdom as yet. So it shows a period of time in which there was, they didn't have the power and authority that the monarchical kings had pre-World War I. But it's true. There's a period of time there. There's so many different things in the Word of God with time prophecies and various prophetic pictures that there are periods of time that we think are long, but apparently to the Lord, he feels are necessary for further development. Sister Debbie.
So technically there are eight kings altogether.
Yeah.
You listed seven, and then they said there were seven and then one is coming. Is that because I'm sorry, it's early.
Well, that's what we went through
last night. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's what we went through in Revelation 17. But the verse is in particular Revelation 17, verse 11. And the beast that was and is not even he is the eighth. So we have an eighth head and is of the seven, which again, they were seven heads. So it has to, we think it's a repeat. And goes into destruction and such. So, all right. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? All right. Barkus.
I don't want anyone to be confused on this. I'm not suggesting anything, but it was just kind of fun that when I was first introduced to Revelation, when we were going through the first volume, before we had Google or anything, I was trying to find what the seven heads were. And I didn't know nothing from nothing. So I went to my Britannica and I looked up Holy Roman Emperors. And you get a list of about 10 or 11 houses. And of those houses from 800 to 1800, there's like seven families or houses that really dominated. And I thought I found the answer. And when I showed Brother Rick and Brother Brad Bach, they were mildly interested. But I had them all highlighted. I thought I had identified the seven heads. But it's just that the reason I mention it is that there is a sense that these could be there could be a sense of horns here, at least during that period, that represented little powers, that were part of the beast, supporting it in some manner. And, you know, the houses are those that you'd recognize, like the Habsburgs and, Luxembourg, and various ones, Carolingian. So. Anyway, I'm just bringing it out as a fun fact. Over.
No, Brother Chris, we appreciate that because there is a list that one of the brethren is, a very fine student has been promoting for years that because in Revelation 17 says the woman sits on the seven mountains, that he makes just about all seven heads or a good proportion of them from 800 onward. But my problem was, and why I didn't fully accept that, was that in Revelation 12, the dragon has seven heads and ten horns. So we, in my mind, we have to start counting the heads with the dragon, not just strictly with the Roman beast or papal beast. So that's why we started with Constantine, and we adopted that thinking that the false church, the woman, would have some influence. Because again, as brought out, she doesn't just ride the beast, sits on the beast for all seven heads. There's times where she's sitting on the waters. So we, you know, have to, we kind of had to, we adopted this kind of a harmonization of all these various verses. But it is, you know, that is true and it is fascinating. Okay. Any other comments on this? Okay. Sister Alice.
The question was, why are the crowns on the, let's see.
Well, the crowns here are on the horns. And in Revelation 12:3, the crowns are on the seven heads. We're going to lead into that right after another moment or two on the sea.
Okay.
Okay. And if you have some input on that, we're happy to entertain it, Sister Alice, for sure. But I wanted to just have us make a little observation on the beast rising out of the sea. And Daniel 7, remember, we were Wednesday night, for those at the study, we were the logical question came up that the wind strove the four winds strove on the sea, and we did an examination of the four winds in other scriptures. And then we saw later in Daniel 7 that these four kings are of the earth. So we were trying to harmonize that, and we were bringing out stable society versus unstable society, and how these empires created stable society out of unstable masses of people. So here in our Revelation 13, this beast rises up out of a sea. There's some sense in which there's this restless mass. And generally the brethren over the years have pointed out that they would think that the papacy rose out of the irreligious masses of paganism, but you can take that extension and that's fine. And yet you could also look at it in the sense that perhaps what it's showing is that when nominal Christianity came into having power, that creates a stable society, nominally Christianized. So in our Revelation 13, that after this beast rises up out of the sea, we see an example in verse 11, 13:11. I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb and spake as a dragon. So we're going to get to that, of course. We've studied this. Brother Russell's brought out, this is the Church of England and Ireland, the two horns. And that the head of the church was King Henry. He started it, and yet he was considered also a religious authority. So it's called a beast, a church and state government. It's a beast. But the point is, at the moment, it comes out of the earth. So once our first beast with seven heads and ten horns, once it is created and developed and comes into authority, it creates an earth class of nominally Christian society under religious restraint, nominal Christian religious restraint. That's what we're offering on that as a suggestion. That's why the second beast, which came up in the 1500s, comes up out of the earth. It came out from papacy. It came out from a earthly, stable, more or less, nominally Christian society. So let's keep that for a moment. This is a thought. And take a look in Revelation. Let's see. There's a lot of verses, but we're just want to choose a couple here. Revelation 18 and verse 21. And let's see. Brother Dan, could you read that for us, please? Revelation 18:21. Brethren, you have my apologies for jumping around. I'm not creating a whole side study, but please bear with me. I think this will make itself clear. Start down.
And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. So here we have the final destruction of Babylon cast into the sea, and that pictures the irreligious masses. We think that part of these irreligious masses would be the burned tares, and so they're worn down to and shall be found no more. So this is the end of the religious aspect of Babylon.
Okay, very, very good. And we appreciate that, as you emphasize, this is when the nominal church systems, papacy and her Protestant daughters, are thrown down with violence. And it's the sea is those who are no longer under their religious restraints. And they tear it down. So it's the burned, bundled tares, the nominal Christians. And we suggest it's a result of the pouring out of the seven last plagues of truths, which convinced the tares that they weren't really Christian and the systems they had supported weren't really Christian. And then they tear it down, much like during the French Revolution, when the French people tore down the Catholic Church, as it were, and the civil government. So we just wanted to emphasize that I think it's one of a number of places in the Revelation where it's like poetic justice, God's retributive justice. The beast came out of the sea only to be cast down with violence back into the sea. So think about that. Any comments here on this verse? Let's take a look at one more here. Revelation 20, verse 13, and Brother Jeff, would you like to read that for us, please? Revelation 20 and verse 13.
The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they had done.
Any comment on that?
No.
Okay. Anyone like to comment on that, this verse for us? Just, and, you know, make the connection we're looking at the sea here. Brother Mark.
Okay. Take a stab at it. So 18:21, we just read, and the strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw them into the sea. And then we just read 21. Oh, I forgot.
2013.
Thank you. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. They were judged, everyone, according to their deeds. And back in 18, we're talking about the bundled tares bundled burn tares at this time. So this sounds like a very similar time period just because of that. And then the judging of the, of the dead that were in the sea in verse 20, which, I mean, to me still sounds future, like in the, at the end of the millennium or the little season or something like that over.
Okay. Well, that gets us started there. Thank you. Brother Chris.
So Babylon is destroyed back into the sea by the irreligious masses is brought out. These are the burnt tares. And now we're reading, this is, that spirals into full anarchy. This is basically, and then we've got Jacob's trouble, where that anarchy comes to a conclusion. And here comes the ancient worthies. It's not mentioned here, but it's implied. And so we've gotten to that, past that step, and now the sea is, the highway is beginning to open up, and death is the final enemy that the Christ, destroys. And so the sea class, it's giving up the dead. It's being dissolved. It's evaporating, as it were, all the dead that were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead. So, we say that the death are the walking dead, all those that have not yet come into a covenant with Christ. Now they are. They're being resurrected from the graves, and they're recognizing, the one who gave them life. And then hell is the grave, the actual dead. And so these are coming up now, and everyone is being judged by their acceptance and obedience to the new covenant arrangement. So the sea is no more. It's, we read other places, Euphrates is dried up. That's a little bit of a different application, but, the sea is this irreligious masses. They all become basically spiritually enlightened, as it were, and there's no sea left, just for emphasis, over.
All right, very good. So appreciate that. So to narrow in the kernel point, with the previous two comments, this is talking about the judgment during the peaceable kingdom, and that everyone who ever lived, as Jesus told us, will come forth from the grave, some to everlasting life, and those to a period of trial, judgment. So here we're told that the sea gave up the dead, death and Hades delivered up the dead and has brought out the sea class, shows those who were not under any religious restraint. They come forth from the grave. Those who were considered dead, the walking dead, like Jesus had said, let the dead bury their dead. The walking dead, those who aren't in a relationship with God, they haven't been made alive in this life. They come forth, into judgment. And then the word hell here is Hades. So it means those who are in the graves, those who already went down in the sleep of death, they are all brought out so that no one is left out of coming, into a condition of having the opportunity to gain life eternal through the highway holiness process and the period of judgment. So that's the thinking there. I want to make an observation that when you think of Hades or the condition of being dead, you know, it's used for the word grave. Like a grave is a place. A place represents a condition. So this is a condition of those who are in the Adamic death sleeping condition. But you make a grave where? You make it in the earth. So by contrast, you have the sea. Sometimes we call it a watery grave. So you have those who were in the sea, those who were in the earth, and you had those who hadn't been buried yet, the walking dead. So all three classes of mankind who were considered dead from God's viewpoint whether actually or not, all will come forth from the grave and have an opportunity to walk up that highway of holiness. Brother Chris.
Yeah, verse 14 kind of sums it up for us. I just noticed this. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And the marginal reading on hell there is the grave in the Oxford. So somebody finally got it right somewhere. And death, that's the Adamic death. This is what we were talking all about in a previous study. And hell there is the condition of death, the Adamic death curse is gone, and hell, any kind of a grave, that condition to the holding, the prison house of death is closed forever. And so they're thrown into the lake of fire, which shows complete oblivion on those things. They're not going to be back. Only second death remains here. Over.
Okay, the possibility of second death remains, and it's always there, because if you eliminated it as a condition, everyone would have to be released, and that's impossible. So, okay, good. One last verse, and we'll get back on track. Revelation 21 and verse 1, I'll just read it. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. So here we are back to our point. The first old spiritual powers that were corrupted, the old earth under the corrupted religious powers authority, like the papacy, like the Church of England and such, that's no more. And there's no more sea. There's no more irreligious masses of people. So it's a complete sweep, as it were, that the old order is removed. Brother Chris.
I was thinking about that last week when you were finalizing Revelation 17, verse 18 there. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigned over the cities of the earth. Well, here we have the new city, the real one, the good one. Over.
Very true. So true. The new Jerusalem. Very good. Okay, so was there any comment here on these other verses before we go back to Revelation 13:1? Okay. Well, I hoped that might help us understand, both on our Wednesday night study as well as here, when we're talking about a distinction between a C-class versus an Earth class. And in Revelation 13, we have, when papacy became a power, then it stabilized the restless sea under her power, and nominal Christianity created an earth class. Nominal Christianity creates an earth class. So it stabilized society in that sense. Okay. So now we'll talk about the placement of the crowns. So in Revelation 13:1, the 10 horns have 10 crowns. And in Revelation 12 and verse 3, there appeared another wonder in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. Would someone like to explain that distinction for us? Sister Shaw.
Well, thanks to your notes, 12 would show the crowns on the head. Civil authority has the main control. And in 13:1, the crown on the horns is showing it's now a religious authority backed by the civil government. Over.
Okay. Well, very good. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's that simple. Depending on which head is the government at that time of the setting, if the head government is chiefly a civil power, then the crown is depicted on the head. if the government is chiefly a religious authority, then the crowns are depicted on the horns. I'm just repeating what Sister Cheryl just said. So the crown denotes rulership. And so we could see it has a thought of going along with the kings. And the main point we brought out in Revelation 17 in our discussion was we believe that the horns are on the head. And it's the head, it's the government that then controls the powers. Horns represent power. So it represents the powers under its influence. And when we talk about the Roman Empire, it's an empire, but it has many countries or tribes under its influence. Not always 10, sometimes more, sometimes less, but 10 shows a complete number. So I think that was the emphasis we were putting there. Brother Chris.
Okay, I'm just trying to put this together then. Well, this beast is rising out of the sea. So this is its beginning, basically. And it's during the dragon, right? There's basically the civil power that's around while this is coming out of the sea. So we kind of put that around 300, 313-ish.
Can I be so rude as to interrupt for a second?
Sure.
In Revelation 12, we had the infant child come forth. When in Revelation 13, when we now see this beast rising up, being a form of government, it's a little later than 300s. Okay. It gets us to at least our 500s.
All right, that clears it up.
Okay, good. And so I have for emphasis, again, that Revelation 12, verse 4 and 5. Let's go ahead and read that, because, like I said, if we had gone systematically, it would have probably been in our memories there. Sister Connie, could you read there, Revelation 12? Well, you might as well read 3 through 5, please.
Okay. And they have seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his heads 7 diadems. And his tail draweth a third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth, and the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. And she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne.
And 6, too, sorry.
And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days.
Okay. Comments on this, Sister Connie?
No.
Okay. All right. Ruth, how would you explain these verses?
Well, the red dragon is Rome, pagan Rome, I believe. And
the tail?
Yeah, the tail would have been, I believe, Constantine, that he drew started getting involved with the church, and he drew aside the stars of heaven. And the stars of heaven were, I think, the leaders of the church that were they at the Council of Nicaea?
Yep, the bishops.
Yeah. And the dragon, which is still pagan Rome.
No, it's not still pagan Rome, not with Constantine.
Well, civil Rome, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That the he wasn't interested in this man-child having any power. So he was trying to devour the child, which is the baby papacy. And so when the man-child was born, it was a counterfeit. It was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, which is really, it's more the papacy that was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. But that's a quote from the Psalms, I believe. So they were applying the scriptures that applied to Jesus to this baby man-child, which basically they applied the scriptures to the Pope as the rule, as the leader of the church. And the man-child was caught up to heaven, as the way you looked at it from the reverse is that now this man-child is the authority in the ecclesiastical realm. And the true woman, who wasn't in harmony with that, had to flee into the wilderness and for 1260 days, which is, I think it started in 539 and went to 1799.
All right, very good. And we like that emphasis that you said in verse 5, brought forth a man-child who was to rule. Yes, the papacy would have to grow and develop in power before it could exercise the authority as a ruler. But it did eventually get that. Okay. What we're seeing then, again, is this development from the infancy of the mystery of iniquity already at work in the apostles' day, the woman being pregnant. The early church had this element in her of ambition. They weren't really Christian, but they were claiming to be Christian. And then at the Council of Nicaea, when Constantine adopted nominal Christianity, it opened the way for the mystery of iniquity to start to gain greater influence, like it did at the Council of Nicaea. And that's where we start counting our first head over the Roman Empire, because a woman was seated on him, the seven heads. This starts our counting with the first head, Constantine. And it develops. They struggle. The emperors being chiefly civil power, but also religious, against that which was a religious power, until finally the religious power of papacy succeeds. And the dragon has to give its power unto the beast. And that creates the church state government of the papacy. And we're seeing that development. Comments on that? Okay. Now, is everyone following us so far? Because, you know, I hate to just have us keep going if this is like not making any sense. It's okay to, if it's not, it's complex. Brother Mark.
What makes the crowns move from the heads to the horns over?
Okay. Let's have someone put it again. Cheryl did it once. I did it once, and we might not be saying it very well. Who could put it in their own words? Sister Debbie.
Well, what I understood was that at a certain point in time, the diadems were on the heads because the heads represent civil government. And then later on in time, the diadems or crowns wind up on the horns because a religious government took over. So now, but it's like two different times. Like in the beginning, it was the civil government, the red dragon, and then later on, it's the beasts, which is the religious government. So I guess we're looking at two different times, the time before papacy came into power and the time after, when the horns represent the religious power. I hope I got that right. Over.
That's how I'd understand it, yeah. Brother Mark, does that address the question? Okay, good. All right. Anyone else on any aspect of this so far? Okay. So in our we move in on 13 verse 1, upon the heads, the names of blasphemy. So this is new because we just read in Revelation 12 about the great red dragon having seven heads and 10 horns. Didn't say anything about blasphemy there. So how does this also help us understand that this beast is a religious government with these names of blasphemy? Brother Chris.
Well, as brought out, that only a religious authority can blaspheme God's name. The red dragon, pagan, was never referred to as being blasphemous. They were just doing what pagans always do. But it's only when they took the name of God as a power over the people can they be blasphemous in making the claims that they do. I think that's it. Over.
Okay. All right. So, Sister Debbie.
Well, in the Young's, it says upon its heads a name of evil speaking. And I like that, because evil speaking, you would think, yeah, it's against God. They have to, like Brother Chris brought out, they have to believe in Jesus Christ first, because Jesus Christ is linked to God Almighty, the Father. And that's the only time, like Brother Chris brought out, that they could evil speak. And the evil speaking, to me, is the bad doctrines that are brought out. Is the, you know, the blasphemous doctrines. Like, in Daniel, where it talks about the, well, you're going to have to finish that because my brain, it just went blank. Okay. Over.
All right, so thank you. In verse 5 and 6, again, we're told about how this beast speaks forth blasphemies, and he blasphemies against God and against his name, God's name, and against his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven, and he spoke great things and blasphemies. So Constantine was a nominal Christian, but he didn't claim to be God on earth. He was a nominally Christian emperor, but he didn't claim to be God on earth. It's the papacy with the line of popes that they claim that their pope was God on earth. They claim he was the vicar of Christ. They claim that he took all these titles. Even in the 12th chapter, he's introduced to us, the man of sin becomes Michael, who as God, right? But it's the counterfeit Michael. So here's our point. It's now when you have the papacy developed, coming into being as a religious government, rising to power in the 500s, 533 and 539, that now they are in a position to blaspheme God more so than Constantine ever did. He didn't claim all those things. In fact, Constantine and the dragon were contrasted with Michael, the counterfeit Michael in Revelation 12. That was the blasphemy, claiming to be, as it were, like Michael. And so you and I, we've read in the second volume in the Man of Sin chapter, Brother Russell has a whole page of all these blasphemous titles and claims that the popes have made over the centuries. And they were still making them in 1870, right? They were making blasphemous claims. Speaking ex cathedra, he was infallible. Remember that? Well, maybe you're not familiar with that. But the Pope declared in 1870 that if he sat in his chair of authority, so to speak, his position of authority, speaking ex cathedra, that was infallible. So it made a mere mortal in our eyes, claiming to be infallible, that's blasphemy. So he did some other things in 1872. But nonetheless, in this situation, it's this beast, this a church, a religious government, a church-state government, is worse than the dragon in God's sight because of these blasphemous claims, as we know. Okay. So, was there anything more on this verse 1? Ruth.
I'm trying to get my head around that it says upon his heads, plural, the name of blasphemy, because the way I think of it is it would be on the head, the particular head that was the papal head, but it's plural, on the heads. So I was wondering if the heads were blaspheming also because they were claiming to be put in power by God and representing God's government. Could that be?
Well, I don't view it that way, but I understand how it's a challenge. Ruth, reread Revelation 12, verse 3. And like I said, I understand this is a challenge, so.
And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads.
But why do we have 7 crowns on its heads? But when really, when we get to the beast, it has 7 heads and 10 horns, but the crown isn't on the heads. It's on the horns.
Good question.
Right. So it's the same with the names of blasphemy. So here's my suggestion. It's just a suggestion, brethren. Take it for what it's worth. It's probably not very satisfying. But in the vision, John on the Isle of Patmos is literally seeing a pantomime being played out somehow before his mind. And when he's seeing this, he's got to see the dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. He doesn't see, bear with me, he doesn't see 7 individual dragons, each with a head and horns. He doesn't see a 7 beasts, each with 1 head and 10 horns. He sees the composite. Every time he gets a vision, he sees the image of what represents the Roman Empire. It's a dragon with 7 heads at once, the 10 horns on those 7 heads. Even though there's only 1 head at a time, we prove that in Revelation 17. Now, in Revelation 13, he's seeing a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns, even though it's only 1 head that's actually in power on that beast. But if he saw a dragon with only 1 head, you wouldn't say it's the 7 heads. If you saw a beast with 1 head, you say, well, where's the other 6 heads? So we have to remember the way it was shown to John. It was in a pantomime picture so that we would have this identifier of 7 heads and 10 horns representing the Roman Empire. Revelation 17 teaches the heads are successive. They follow one another. And so when we're looking at these verses that say the crowns are on the heads or the names of blasphemy are on the heads, it's only because John had to see it that way. Now, I have to leave it there at that. I don't have anything better to offer. And so take it for what it's worth. And I'm happy to have other comments on that. Sister Debbie.
I always looked at it like, you have this one government that spans this long period of time. Rome, the Roman Empire lasted 500 years or thereabouts, and then it didn't really disappear. It just changed hands or changed heads, as it were, for the rest of the time till 1799. So it became the Holy Roman Empire. And that's what it was called by all the popes and the kings and everything. Charlemagne called it the Holy Roman Empire, all of that. So the Roman Empire never went away, but it had all these, like you said, successive people in charge of it or in control of what was important in that beast or in that dragon. So that's kind of the way I was looking at it. Just, it's a very big dragon if you drag it along the timeline. But it has all these heads at each particular point in the timeline. Over.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Can I just leave it there as food for thought? And we'll just keep going forward? Okay, Sister Alice.
I just don't remember the history very well, but one of the heads was the Nazis and fascists. Were they connected with the religion, with papacy?
Well, you will remember that the Pope did not condemn Nazism very strongly, and the papacy was really ridiculed for cooperating with the Nazis and not taking a stronger position. And the Nazis actually thought they were Christian. And they were considered the Third Reich. They were going to rule the Roman Empire in an Aryan Christian superhuman manner. And they used the cross as well as the swastika and other symbolisms in their insignia. So the papacy was been soundly condemned. In fact, there was a book out called Hitler's Pope, condemning that. I'm not remembering his name. I'm not sure if it was a Pius or a John, but nonetheless, the papacy tried to present themselves that they hid some Jews at the Vatican. So they tried to use that to skirt the criticisms that they didn't say more. And by the way, Christians who didn't agree, true Christians or those who were true in their faith, who didn't agree, like our brethren and Jehovah Witnesses, and you might remember the name Bonhoeffer. He was a Protestant, but he spoke out against Nazis. They all went to the death camps. But the papacy and the Catholics weren't going to the death camps. And so they went along with it. So I guess I have to leave it there. Ruth and then Sister Debbie.
There's a book called A Woman Rides the Beast. And, in that book, he documents the fact that the Nazi war criminals that had to leave Europe, that were trying to escape from Europe, they got out of Europe through the Vatican, cars, like limousines and things that would drive them to the border. And the Allies knew that they were in those cars, but they couldn't do anything because the Vatican had diplomatic immunity. So that's how all those Nazi war criminals got out of Europe and got to South America.
Yeah, the rat line. And just before Sister Debbie, you remember that Mussolini was given, well, I'll say a billion. I get my number. It might be a million, but nonetheless, liar. Italian form of money to the papacy, and he brought the papacy back into limelight in Italy, and the people were so grateful for Mussolini to do that, he got the name El Duce. They loved him. And so that's the fascist angle of connected with the papacy. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, that was part of what I was going to bring out is, and if Cassie wants to, she can put it in the chat because I don't remember the author, but she told me about this book, The Pope and Mussolini, which lists all of that, that the Pope never actually, like you was brought out, never actually stopped or spoke against Nazism or what was happening with the Jews, not out there. Even when some of the priests were put into the concentration camps, still Papacy didn't speak out against them. And the Roman Empire never really disappeared. It was like the scripture where it says that the beast got the terrible wound, but it survived it, that you, everybody thought it was dead in 1799, that Napoleon killed the Holy Roman Empire. But actually it came back and Napoleon wanted to be the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And he called himself, you know, emperor. And the Roman Empire never really disappeared. It's still there, like under wraps, and it keeps changing hands. You know, sometimes it's in the Pope's hands, sometimes it's in the civil hands, like Napoleon, but it never really disappeared. The wound to the head never, you know, didn't kill the beast, as it were. So anyway, that's all. Over.
Okay, thank you. And, yeah, today, we would think of the European Union as part of the modern form of a Roman Empire-esque type of setting. Thank you. Brother James.
Yeah, all these stories about the papacy through time, I think those are the blasphemous names. It's not just titles or even doctrines, but also their actions and their stances on things, because they put themselves in the place of God. So they're representing to the world, they're representing God's kingdom on earth. You know, and that's like what, that's what they claim. And then that's how people, a lot of people see them. That's how a lot of the world sees them, both believers and non-believers. They understand that non-believers would understand that the Catholic Church sees themselves as God's representatives. And then they do all these atrocious things. So that ruins God's character. It maligns God's character to mankind. So I see that all of these things being blasphemous, and it would be a horrible study, but you could go through each one of these heads and see all the terrible things that papacy has done in order to misrepresent God. Over.
Well, good point. We appreciate that. Even last week's news, for those who saw it, as sad as it is the Baltimore, much like what had happened in Boston, depicted in the movie Spotlight, which won the Oscar for Best Picture Award a few years ago. It just last week, they revealed in Baltimore the same thing. Over 600,000 sex abuse victims at the hands of the Baltimore Roman Catholic Archdiocese took place over a 60-year period, finally. So, you know, to this very day, in this country, you still have these abuses that went reported for decades. Okay. So I don't think there's any one of us here that doubts that the papacy has many blasphemous claims and titles associated with it doctrinally, by its claims of authority and by its abusive practices of each and every kind, particularly with the doctrine of transubstantiation. Okay. So our time is winding down for today. I think we did get our verse one. In verse two, we could see that it'll be interesting as we continue this coming Wednesday in our Daniel study, that we see that there's a connecting link here to 13 verse 2, which we'll discuss next week, Lord willing here. I'll just say one last little point is it was interesting in our study on the horns. We spent so much time in Daniel 7 on the horns. And we learned so much there about papacy, the 11th or little horn, that here we're seeing in this 13 verse 2, we're going back to Daniel 7. And not on the horns, but we're looking at the three previous beastly empires before the Roman Empire, which this beast that we're considering represents. So,